KSL at Night was recorded and produced this afternoon. KSL at Night. Some of Utah's top political specialists join a roundtable on the day's biggest stories. KSL is at 102.7 FM and on every smart speaker when you say play KSL News Radio.
Good evening and welcome to KSL at Night. I'm your host this evening, Leah Murray. I am KSL's resident political science professor. And I'm going to just tell you what, settle in for the best radio you possibly could be listening to for all the things you need to know. And if you've missed out on any of our shows or you're driving, you want to check back in to learn more or listen more closely, you can always go back and listen to it on KSLpodcast.com after our shows have been aired. Just look up KSL at Night. All right, let's get into what maybe is the top issue in America right now. Immigration, one of the top concerns for U.S. voters as we head into our next national election. And a lot of politicians have been trying to figure out how to solve what probably has been, you know, a top issue for America for, you know, decades, if not the entire time we have been a country. Over the weekend, our Congresswoman Celeste Molloy paid a visit to Sierra Vista, a border town in southeastern Arizona. Congresswoman Molloy, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
I'm excited to be here with you.
Thank you. Can you tell us about, so a little bit, let's just dive into this issue. This is your second border trip. I think you went to Texas and then now you're in Arizona. First, kind of tell us what you're seeing. Does that make sense? Like what is happening at the border? And then maybe dive into how, you know, like what it looks different, like how Arizona looks a little different from what you saw when you were in Texas.
Yeah, I wanted to see when I was in Texas, I heard that the border problems in Arizona were different than the border problems in Texas. So I knew I wanted to go see it for myself. And it did look very different. When I was in Texas, we spent a lot of time talking about asylum seekers and masses of people coming over the border and how many people they had to process, how many people the Border Patrol was trying to round up. In Arizona, the conversation was very different. They talked about smugglers coming across the border with drugs. They talked about people who are trying to get across the border and disappear, not necessarily asylum seekers. And the way they handle those are very different. And so it was educational that way, that when we talk about border problems, the border is long and different parts of the border have different problems.
I think that is so interesting, actually, right? So right there, I was wondering, I feel like I'm not sure who's supposed to solve the problem, Congresswoman Molloy, right? Like, should it be the federal government? Maybe it's supposed to be states, but it feels like it's federal. But then what you just said sounds like different states have different issues. And so maybe the states should be given more leeway. Can you help us or help me just kind of understand, you know, whose job is it? Which maybe it's many, many people's job. And that's a complicated question.
Yeah, no, it is clearly the federal government's job. This is an international border. And that's one of the things the federal government is actually required to do is, you know, immigration and national security. So the federal government should be doing this job. And the federal government should be nimble enough to do the job differently in Texas than in Arizona. And part of the problem we talked about in Arizona is that the feds aren't communicating very well with local law enforcement. They're not sharing information very well with the local law enforcement. And that creates an even bigger problem than they'd have if they were just talking to each other and we still had this administration that is not using the tools they have at their disposal to try to control the border. And so the states are having to step up and do the federal government's job, but it shouldn't be on their shoulders to do this. This is clearly a federal responsibility.
All right. So I thank you. That makes total sense to me. So how would it look? Because I feel like in the last couple of weeks, maybe I'm watching like a 60 Minutes Congresswoman and they were interviewing Border Patrol and they were talking about how they don't have a lot of direction from the Biden administration. Right. So I want to be clear. I'm pulling that, you know, from my memory. So just talk to us about what is happening. I feel like in the article you had said that I was reading on KSL.com that you had said you didn't see a single Border Patrol agent, but someone else told you it's because they were doing processing. I'm just kind of wondering if this were working well, right, between the federal government and local law enforcement, like what would you expect to see and how should it be operating?
If this were working well, we'd have general control over our border. There's always going to be somebody trying to come across illegally, But if we had general control, the Border Patrol agents that we have would be out picking up the people who are coming across illegally. The problem right now is we have so many people coming across that the Border Patrol can't arrest people and process people. They just don't have enough agents. So adding more agents only tries to deal with the problem at the level we have. What we need to do is enforce the law, be sending people back if they're coming here illegally, requiring people to remain in Mexico until they get asylum, instead of having them all coming across our border. We're just overwhelmed. And we have, you know, in Arizona, we have people who are professionals at sneaking people across that border. It's not like people are just walking across the border and they don't know what they're doing and they're easy to pick up. People are being smuggled across the border by people who know exactly how to smuggle them across the border.
Right. And I guess, I mean, maybe I feel like this, what you talked about, how in Texas, people were seeking asylum. In Arizona, it just sounds like criminal activity. A little bit, I'll be honest with you and say I'm a little more sympathetic, you know what I mean, to asylum seekers, because I feel if you're trying to get here and it's bad where you were, I understand that. But how do we manage... Right. Like what is like how do we goodness, this is such a hard question. But Congresswoman, how do we fix that? Right. So how do we get people, you know, to stay where they are, or how do we make sure that they're not coming across the border? Because there's like a million migrants just this year. And I hear you completely when you say we're overwhelmed. Do we need help from other nations? I mean, like, how could we negotiate this to make it better?
No, we just need to start enforcing the laws we already have. All of the same authorities we had 4 years ago, we have now. None of them have been rescinded, and we had much better control over the border 4 years ago. We need to be sending people back across the border when we pick them up. We're not doing that. We need to require people to remain in Mexico until they get granted asylum. We're not doing that. We're letting them come here and apply for asylum. And so the incentive structure is all wrong, and the numbers are way too high.
Yeah, and I understand, too, we've talked on this show a number of times, like the cartel, right, is involved in it, right? And so that there's like go ahead, tell us about that.
No, the cartels are involved, different cartels on different parts of the border, and I think that's part of the reason that it's not the same problems law enforcement is seeing, it's because they're dealing with different cartels. But they do have control south of the border, and we don't have control north of the border. And the combination of those two things is what's causing this problem. And one of the things that I saw on both border trips that I keep talking about because I think it's so important, if you think that the humanitarian thing to do is to just leave the border open and let people come here, you need to go down and see what's happening at the border, because by not controlling our border, we've created a market for the cartels south of our border. And the things that are happening are absolutely inhumane. Cartels are holding people for ransom and hurting them and hurting their kids until they get paid. They're putting people in trunks and sending them across the border in cars and telling the driver of the car, do not stop for law enforcement no matter what. And they're getting in high-speed chases with human beings in the trunk. The things that are happening because we don't have control of our border are not humane for someone who's trying to come here for a better life.
Oh my gosh. Thank you so much for that right there, right? That we are actually maybe causing a humanitarian crisis by not enforcing our laws. I appreciate that point. Congresswoman Malay, can you tell us, and I've only got like a minute left with you, what is the next step? Like, what could we do to make our government enforce these laws?
Well, Congress can pass laws and then the administration has to enforce them. And right now we have a Secretary of Homeland Security who's telling the agencies not to enforce the laws the way they're written. And so one of the things we can do is impeach him. We didn't change anything. I'm afraid the only way we're going to get this fixed is with an election. We need a different person in the White House, so we have different directions coming from the administration.
Thank you so much, Congresswoman Celeste Malloy. I appreciate the conversation and thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
All right. Next up on KSL at Night, the Census Bureau is changing how it categorizes people, starting with the next census in 2030. We're going to get into it after the break.
KSL at Night.
Good evening and welcome back to KSL at Night. You're here with me, Leah Murray, and we are chatting about all the things that are happening. One interesting thing that I noted in an article today in The Hill was that the Census Bureau is changing the way that we count people. So I just want to like say, for the record, we have been counting people in this country since our first census in 1790, and we are constitutionally required to do so. So that's a thing that's happened every 10 years, and it goes all the way back. And I am someone who likes to trace my family history, and I have been deep in archival research looking at census data, trying to find ancestors, right? And maybe some of you have done that as well. But how we do it, like how we actually categorize or what boxes you get to check, are left in large part to bureaucrats at the Census Bureau to decide how best to measure the demography of our country. So, and I do this as a hobby, right? But there are experts in our area who actually do this for a living. And so we've got one of those experts with us tonight, Mallory Bateman, the Director of Demographic Research at the Kempsey Gardner Policy Institute. Mallory, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So first, I wonder if I could do kind of the abstract theoretical question first, if that's okay, Mallory. And like, the OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, just announced that it would create a new task force to review how the collection of race and ethnicity data for future changes happen so that it would better reflect the changing demographics of the country. Can you talk to us about like why this matters, right? So what is it about how we label, whether we say Hispanic or Latino, whether we add a category for North African or Middle Eastern, like what does it mean? Why is that important to be very thoughtful about how we write these categories and to be reviewing them for change going forward?
Yeah, I mean, it's important because it's one thing that we get to self-identify, right? And I know everyone doesn't mark Census Day on their calendar, but when I got the form, I was pretty excited that there was a box that meant, like, I identified with and it meant something to me. And I think as we continue to diversify racially and ethnically throughout the U.S., those boxes don't fit everybody. And so you have a lot of people who fall into, there is a some other race category, but then it's also difficult using that some other race category if you're trying to look into maybe issues, maybe communities aren't being served properly, or people can't access the things they need. And so it's a tricky, tricky situation. You know, so you mentioned 1790 was the first census. And since the first census, this race and ethnicity concept has kind of shifted and morphed over time. And so as we continue to have more identities as Americans, I think it's important to reflect those in these kind of administrative records.
Yeah, no, I think that's so interesting. I talk to students about how when the Census Bureau adds the word Hispanic, right, like all of a sudden you find in America all sorts of people who were already here. Right. They just didn't see themselves, like you said, reflected in that form as an identity for them to check. Do you have a sense? And this is the first change they've made since 1997. So it's been 27 years. Mallory, do you have a sense for like what we might see? And I'm thinking nationally, but also speak to Utah as well. When we add a Hispanic or Latinos, when we make that something specific, which is no longer ethnicity, I guess. And so talk to us about that. Like when they're, let's do that first. So when they're making those changes, what do the labels like, what do they mean now? What are the changes that are being made?
Yeah. So before this OMB announcement today, they were two separate questions. So you would answer if you were Hispanic or Latino in one question, and then you would answer if you identified in one of five or six different race groups. And so a Hispanic or Latino person could select yes or no, and then go to the next section of boxes and select something that suited them. But the Census Bureau found that that was really confusing for a lot of respondents. And you can kind of see that in some of the 2020 census data. You know, you get a lot of some other race and then people write in Mexican or they write in El Salvadorian. And so the intent of this was to hopefully make it less confusing for people responding to the questionnaires. And it went through, I will say this has gone through, you know, over a decade worth of development and research and had been planned for the 2020 census and then kind of got shelved at the last minute. So there was a lot of homework that went into making this decision to switch.
I like that right there, Mallory. So let me ask that follow-up question, then I'll loop back to what I was trying to get to before, not super well. Were you part of that homework? Like, Mallory, is it people like you who do the work that you do across the country that are informing? Does that make sense, these decisions when they're doing that homework?
Yeah, so I personally was not. I came in late to that game, but they do have several working groups that are made up of different professionals all over the U.S. in different fields in academia, in nonprofits, in the public sector and private sector that come together, I think quarterly, to discuss all kinds of issues at the Census Bureau. And then they have research teams within the Census Bureau that are doing their own work. They have research teams at OMB. And so it was a big lift to try to make sure any of these changes would be useful and not a harm.
Yeah, right. Okay. We do no harm first, right?
Hopefully.
So when we're changing, so you talked about why, like you were saying, for the 2020 election, it was a little confusing for people as they were picking Hispanic or Latino, and then they had another separate set. Can you talk to us about what you think with this new way of doing it? What do you expect? You know, like what people will we find? Does that make sense? Like we add,
yes.
And we were talking about Hispanic or Latino, but they also added Middle Eastern or North African as a possible category. You know, I'm just kind of wondering, what do you think the demographic landscape starts to look like? And I think I'm interested nationally and also inside of Utah.
Yeah, so I think nationally, the expectation is that the white alone share of population, non-Hispanic white alone, is one group. And the expectation is that group is going to decline with this new Middle Eastern North African category, because that group had been included in white. White includes a lot of people, and all of the people that are supposed to check the box in the, you know, Census Bureau theory aren't necessarily identifying as white. So that's one change that we'll expect to see. We do have some insights with the 2020 census data, looking into people could write in their background. So that was kind of the compromise with this, not changing the question, but getting some additional insight. So we do have a little bit of understanding of the Middle Eastern North African population in Utah, and it's there, you know, it's a sizable population. I don't know that it's going to be a seismic shift to that kind of white overall. But then it's also, you know, we don't totally know because people can check more than one box. And so maybe it doesn't completely change our accounting, for lack of a better term, of the population. Like if we wanted to see the people who did not mark Hispanic and identified as one race alone, I think we'll still have that ability to do that. But I think with this, we'll be able to get a little more depth of understanding of who's living in Utah and the U.S.
I'm so interested in what you just talked about a little bit about white as a category. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think one, we are self-reporting, right? So
yes.
I loved, it was 2020 and it was a pandemic, but man, I had census day on my, like I was waiting for that envelope too. So Mallory, I was with you, but I'm just kind of like, I get to pick, you know, and I wonder
exactly
to what extent there is a value add in America to choose different categories. Does that make sense? And then I wonder, generationally, do you see different things, right? So if I'm like three generations of Middle Eastern and we all picked white before, are we path dependent, or maybe do younger generations see some value in choosing that identity? Could you like flesh that out a little bit for me?
Yeah, I definitely think there are differences across generations. One thing that we saw this time around with 2020 census is the two or more race categories. So multiracial individuals grew by leaps and bounds, both in Utah and the nation. And you saw that really largely in younger populations, especially under 18. So we do have, I think, different ways of thinking about race as a concept. And I think having more options that are potentially more inclusive will be helpful maybe for people. I do think, you know, some communities might be hesitant to answer with, you know, what they would identify as because they're not sure when they're reporting to the government, you know, how it's going to go. But hopefully people know that these responses are anonymous and they're protected. And so hopefully people will feel comfortable to identify how they feel. But yeah, there is some variability across generations that we're already seeing in the data without this wording switch.
All right. Mallory Bateman, Director of Demographic Research at the Kemsey Gardner Policy Institute. Thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thanks for having me.
Next up on KSL at Night, let's get into politics. There was an early election that went the Democrats' way kind of unexpectedly, and we're going to talk about what that means.
KSL at Night.
All right. right, welcome back to KSL at Night. You're here with me, Leah Murray, and I am having a good conversation with people about all the interesting news of the day. For this segment, I want to bring in Taylor Morgan, who is one of our KSL co-hosts and a partner at Morgan & May Public Affairs. Taylor, welcome to the show.
Hey, Leah. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, Taylor, I appreciate you joining me for this conversation because there's nothing I love more than chatting what things might mean in politics with you because you're really good at talking about this. So let me just tell you the story and then let's talk about it. In Alabama, a Democrat won a special election to the Alabama state legislature. So for our listeners who don't know about Alabama, it's a pretty red state. I think it kind of looks like Utah, right? There are no statewide elected Democrats. Democrats are a super minority in that state legislature. And this woman wins this special election by making abortion rights, Taylor, the centerpiece of her campaign. So it's a suburban seat in Alabama. She talks a lot about abortion. And you might remember, Taylor, Alabama's got abortion with no exceptions law. Like their trigger ban was no exceptions, right? So they're like, nobody can have an abortion there. So she talks about that a lot. I am wondering, I want you to like chime in with me and like think about this with me. I think this is a sign of what might be coming for Republicans nationally in suburban districts. So is it kind of like if you run on abortion and you are in a suburban district, which is exactly what happened up in Long Island when they ran to replace George Santos. So that's a congressional seat, right, Taylor? And it's still a suburban seat. And the Democrat ran on abortion rights and won handily. You have this woman in Alabama winning handily on that abortion rights. Maybe the N is too small, but what do you think? Like, I'm feeling like this could be some kind of bellwether.
Well, I don't know about a bellwether. I do think that we do have a pattern, a clear pattern of abortion becoming a key issue that is actually moving voters across party affiliations and across candidates in multiple states and races, Kansas, Georgia, Alabama, you mentioned New York. Now, these districts are not necessarily copy-paste to many other red states across the country. And especially this issue, it just doesn't necessarily track in the same ways across the country. For example, you mentioned how extreme Alabama's abortion ban was following the overturn of Roe v. Wade. Utah also had a trigger law. That trigger law is on hold right now. But Utah's trigger law could be argued is far less, not quite as extreme or far-reaching as Alabama's. And so even though the issue is indeed becoming front and center, and it is having an impact on voters and turnout, it's not necessarily applied or perceived the same way state to state, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. And your point's well taken. Utah's abortion ban has exceptions built in, right? Like life of the mother, right, I think is part of it. So if you were advising people running a campaign here, so let's pretend you've been hired by some Democrat in a suburban seat in Utah, you feel like maybe it wouldn't stick as much, right? Because it's not that maybe it's because Alabama's was so strict that gives it a little bit more legs?
That's exactly right. And we're also talking about different jurisdiction here, right? This special election, as you started off mentioning, was a legislative seat, right? We're talking about flipping blue to red, but in a legislative district. And it could be argued that that is because it is the Alabama state legislature that voters are frustrated with because of the very extreme, far-reaching trigger ban following Roe v. Wade. So that would not necessarily apply to congressional candidates. It also may not apply to Utah candidates seeking legislative office or certainly congressional office. It's the issue is certainly becoming even more prominent, but I do have to say that abortion has always been a prominent issue, and especially among Republicans. It has been the rallying cry in the National Republican Party since the original passage of Roe v. Wade. This Supreme Court was essentially put in place over the course of many decades by Republican office holders and operatives, all to undo Roe v. Wade 2 years ago. So it's a key issue. It always has been a key issue. It's having an impact, but I don't see it as an indicator of any sweeping broad national trend.
Gotcha. All right. Well, so then let me kind of ask you, I thought it was interesting. The Democratic Legislative Campaign Committee President Heather Williams in Alabama talked about how this win was rare, right? Like it would be, you know, like Alabama's very Republican, very red state, and a Democrat winning was just very rare. Like it would look, it was just interesting. And she said the victory was a political earthquake in Alabama. So I hear what you're saying. Like you're feeling like abortion is not, right, the thing that's going to be sweeping. We've got no kind of major tsunami necessarily coming. But if you were looking at Utah's politics, what would you need to see, right, to see any kind of sign that maybe people here were fed up with the state legislature, that maybe people here, like what would look like a political earthquake in the state of Utah if you could, like, not that I'm saying, you know, that you want it to happen. I'm just saying, like, what would it look like that you'd be going, oh, no, maybe this is a thing?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. Perhaps to start specifically with the issue of abortion, you know, Utah and Utah Republicans have long had a very nuanced position on abortion that is very different than national Republicans, and it is certainly unique to Utah. A big part of that is the position of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints on abortion that has really influenced Utah Republicans' position on that. So, Utah's trigger ban, it is, mind you, on hold. So there has not been public outcry directly here about that. Abortion itself is not a state-moving issue when it comes to voters, while voters are aware of it. If we're going to have a political earthquake, to be honest with you, Leah, it's more likely to come from the far right in Utah than it is from the left. Some in Utah, well, Democrats mostly, are trying to argue that Utah is becoming purple or turning blue, and it's simply not true. Affiliation numbers tell a different story. The affiliation by elected officials tells a different story, and turnout by voters tells a different story. So Utah is even more red today than it ever has been. Any earthquake would be within the red from the far right.
Oh, that's so interesting, right? So what you're saying, maybe we're looking at a political earthquake, you know, like in our Senate race that we've got going on, right? So it's kind of like if we're going to see a far right candidate win, that would be where you'd see the interesting movement.
That's exactly right. Yep. Right now I'm picking Brent Orrin Hatch as the dark horse Senate candidate in that primary because, Leah, he has millions and millions of dollars of national money coming in from far right conservatives supporting him. And he's running with his dad's name on the ballot.
Taylor Morgan, partner at Morgan & May Public Affairs. Thank you so much for joining us tonight and having this conversation with me. And I hear you that it's not a bellwether, but I don't know, how many districts do you think, Taylor, would it take? I call you again and I say, this one's it. How many, what would the N have to be of suburban districts moving?
Oh, well, we're talking about a dozen suburban legislative districts. You got to have a couple hundred before it means much.
I gotcha. I'll keep counting and then I will call you back.
Okay,
Taylor
perfect.
Morgan, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks, Lee. Bye-bye.
All right. So listeners, today was opening day for baseball. And the answer on KSL at night is we're not going to talk about sports because we don't talk about sports. We talk about politics and policy and all those interesting things. But I'm going to tell you what, I'm a baseball fan, so I can't help but think a little bit about baseball on opening day. Makes me think about baseball, makes me think about ballparks. So in our next segment, we're going to have a conversation about Salt Lake City's ballpark neighborhood and some of the plan changes that might be coming.
KSL at night. KSL at night.
And welcome back to KSL at night. You're here with me, Leah Murray, and we are talking about all the interesting things that are happening. And if you've missed out on any of our shows or you are catching us in the middle of one of these segments and you want to go back and listen more carefully, you can listen to it on KSLpodcast.com after the show's been aired. Just look up KSL at night. All right, listeners, so here's the thing. One of my favorite local entities are planning commissions all across America. These are the people who make decisions about what things are going to look like in communities. My dad served for years as a planning commissioner in his county where I grew up, and he would make decisions about, you know, like where roads would go and like when you were building a big box store, like what that would look like. And I always tell my own students up at Weber State, if you are at all interested in how communities grow or how they thrive, getting to know your local planners and who's making those decisions, and maybe even going to those open meetings when they have them, is a really good way to do that. Along these lines, there is a new plan just released to the Salt Lake City Council about the southwest corner of Salt Lake City's ballpark neighborhood. So right now, I just mentioned big box stores, right? Right now, this corner filled with big box stores and is a pretty auto-centric place in the city. And city planners released a new plan to try to address what growth might look like over in that corner of the city. We've got with us Nick Norris, planning director at the Salt Lake City Planning Division, to help us understand what's happening. Nick, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, Nick, if I said anything wrong, make sure to correct me. But I hope we're talking about the right side, part of the city that I was mentioning. Can you talk to us about this new plan and a little bit, why are we planning there? Does that make sense? So sometimes I do think cities like Salt Lake City seem, I don't want to say old, but they feel like they've been around for a long time. So you kind of wonder, what planning do you actually need to do? So walk us through like why there is a new plan for this area. What's going on over there?
Sure. So the first thing is obviously the 300 West corridor itself is changing quite a bit. You know, it's historically and traditionally been this really heavy commercial street, you know, like you said, with a lot of the big box retailers located there, some kind of light industrial types of uses as well. It's a really important economic corridor for the city. But we're starting to see that change. And some of that is reflected in some of the work the city's done with rebuilding the street and adding the bike infrastructure and bike paths and things like that and the street trees. But it's also happening because there's a desire for some of those property owners to have their properties be something different. And so we're starting to see apartment buildings built and more restaurants and things like that coming to the corridor. And so that's kind of one of the reasons why, you know, you're never done planning your city, because cities are constantly undergoing different degrees of change. The second part of it is that a couple of years ago, the Utah legislature passed a law that requires all cities to develop what the state law calls station area plans around all of the track stations and streetcar stations and bus rapid transit stations. So a very high percentage of those stations are in Salt Lake City, and we already have stationary plans for most of those, but this is one where we don't have that. And so we're going through that process to create it so that we can satisfy that provision in state code. But more importantly, because we recognize and are experiencing the change that's happening.
No, and your point's so well taken. Cities are living creatures, right, Nick? So they are always dynamically growing and people changing. I appreciate that so much. That point's so well taken. Can you talk to us about how it works? So is it like Nick Norris sits in his room and he thinks about what that would look like and then comes out with a plan? I'm sure that's not how that works, but like, how do you do this work? Like, what are the steps in place?
Yeah, well, Nick Norris does sit in his room and think about those things, but that's not usually fully reflected in the plan. So what we do whenever we're talking about a plan like this is that we first want to make sure that we're talking to people who have some stake in that area, right? So property owners, business owners, residents, people who work in these areas, and understanding how they use the corridor, how they use the station, the track station there, what they experience, what they feel like is makes it harder for them to be in the area for whatever reason, and what kinds of amenities they'd like to see happen there. So, for example, one of the things that we're hearing a lot from the community is that, and this is true, is that there's a lack of open space and, you know, in parks in this immediate area, and that's because of the nature of how it developed over time. And so that's one of those principles that we're like, okay, if we need more parks or open space in this area, how do we go about doing that, and where might that be?
Yeah, and I like how you just said the word principle. I think I was reading in the article on KSL.com that there were four project principles in your plan. So it was like promoting a walkable district, supporting various types of mobility, encouraging mixed-use redevelopment along 300 West and close to the station, creating a system of public and private green spaces. I think that's what you were just talking about. And then also incorporating density near the station area through a variety of housing options. So when you talk about principles, Nick, what does that mean? Like, as you are collecting information and gathering information from the stakeholders and the people who live there and the community, do themes emerge? Does that make sense? And that's how you kind of land on what those principles will look like and guiding you going forward?
Yeah, absolutely. So these are definitely themes. They're also related to various goals that either the mayor or the city council have established for the city. So, you know, we know that housing is a significant issue in the city, and we know that it has many different prongs to it. And whether it's affordability, availability, number of housing of homes that are available for families, you know, and I think you've probably had on your show discussions about the school closures in the city, and that's been in the media a lot. And part of that is, we're seeing fewer households with kids in the city. And so what can we do from a policy perspective to help remove that or change that trend? And so those are how the different principles or goals are identified, and then we'll identify specific actions about how to get there and how to help achieve those goals.
Okay, and so you've presented this, but I feel like that you didn't present it, on a tablet, right? Like, it's not on a stone tablet, right? So it is not necessarily etched in stone yet. Is the process, kind of where are you in the process, right? So I understand you've gathered information. Now you've presented it to the city council. Is there now still time for the public to give feedback, or like, what are your next steps?
So now we're just starting kind of the formal adoption process. So in Salt Lake City, that includes a public input period, and then we'll go to the Planning Commission for a recommendation, and they'll make a recommendation to the city council. And ultimately, the city council will make a decision on whether to adopt the plan or not, or to modify it some way. And the public is always encouraged to provide comment all the way up through that city council action. So there's probably several months left in the total process before the council will make a decision on this.
And if it all goes, I'm just going to say well, because if it all goes well and the city council agrees with what you recommend, when would we expect to start seeing the changes along that corridor?
Yeah, that's a great question, because the change happens over time, right? And so people will probably start seeing some of the early changes, things like changing the zoning to align with the plan. That starts to set the stage for future development to start implementing the plan. Over time, you may see the city invest in certain amenities, like, one of the things the plan identifies is a potential trail along the tracks line. And so you may start seeing discussions about how we go about doing that, working with UTA and making sure that we have enough space to do that without jeopardizing the operations of the light rail line and making sure it stays safe for people and things like that. So they happen over time. Plans are never intended to be, like you said, etched in stone. They're guides to help us make informed decisions as a community over time.
Okay. Nick Norris, Planning Director at the Salt Lake City Planning Division. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Of course. Thank you for your interest in talking to us.
Absolutely. Listeners, thank you so much for listening to KSL at Night. No show tomorrow because there is a Jazz game. And even though they didn't make the postseason, we absolutely are still rooting for them. So go Jazz.